They hog all the speaking time for themselves. Bah. Chapter 9. A virus is too small to be seen through a microscope, and there are more living organisms, viri, bacteria, etc., resident on the skin of a human being than there are humans alive on the earth. About 4,000 of these organisms are crowded into every square centimeter of the arms, and on the head, armpits and groin the figure may be in excess of 2 million. Virus sat in her poor valley thinking of all the problems which beset the people of the world called human. Beside her Brunhilde, her closest virus friend, sat. They quivered pleasantly as only jelly-like Viri could do. Then Vera said, "Oh, I am in such a state of confusion. I have been asked for my vital statistics, and how can I get over to the people that I am a glorious 25 nanometers? Oh, why don't we change to the metric system and have it done with? That would be so much simpler." Brunhilde wobbled violently, and that was meant to be a laugh. Then she said, "Well, you just need to tell people the vital statistics of the NM. Just tell them that one NM is a billionth of a meter, and if they are still so stupid that they don't know what a meter is, we all know it is a thing the electricity man reads, just say that it is equal to 1 millimicron. Frankly, Vera, I think you are making a mountain out of a molehill." "How can you be so asinine, Brunhilde?" retorted Vera with very considerable acerbity. "You know there are no molehills here, and as for moles, well, they haven't been invented yet." She sniffed, "If a virus can sniff," and relapsed into jelly-like silence. The world called human was a very peculiar place. All the inhabitants of the world lived in the valleys or pores. Because, for some remarkable reason which none could ever understand, the world was covered except for certain places with a very strange blanket or cloud or something. It seemed to be immense pillars crisscrossed with such space between it that any agile virus, given a few years, could climb straight up through that barrier and look at space from the surface of this strange material. But it was truly remarkable, because every so often the whole world would endure a flood. Millions of virus people would be instantly drowned, and only people like Vera, Brunhilde, and certain friends of theirs who had seen the wisdom of living in poor valleys survived. It used to be a devastating sight to raise one's antennae above the valley and look at all the bodies littering the plain between adjacent valleys. But no one could ever explain what it was. They knew that at certain intervals of time the great barrier covering most of the world would be removed, and then would come the flood, and then would come another barrier which was violently agitated. After that there would come yet another barrier, and for a time peace. Virus and her friends were sitting in their valley of the poor in a site which was never covered by this barrier. They could look up at the skies above, and Vera, looking up on this occasion, said, "I often wonder, Brunhilde, if there are any other worlds besides ours?" A new voice broke in, a gentleman virus called Bunyanwera, who had been born from a Ugandan culture, or at least that had been in the racial memory of his ancestors. Now he was just another inhabitant of the world called human. He said, "Oh nonsense, Vera, nonsense. You know perfectly well there are thousands, millions, of worlds like ours. Haven't we glimpsed them in the distance at times? But then, we don't know if they have any life upon them, do we?" A fourth voice called out, "Well, I think this world was made especially for us. Another world in existence with life on like ours. I think the whole world was made by God just for us viruses. Look at the advantages we have. There is no form of intelligence to be compared with ours. We have special valleys dotted about, and if they are not made especially for us, how did they come about?" The speaker, Katagwama, was an erudite sort of fellow. He had been around a bit, he had even moved as far as the next valley of the poor. So the others listened to his opinion with respect. But then suddenly Bunyanwera burst out, "Oh nonsense, nonsense, there's no such thing as a god. Of course there isn't a god. I've prayed time after time for little things to be done for me, and if there was a god, do you think he would allow one of his children to suffer? Look at me, I've got part of my jelly crushed. It happened when I got too close to the top of the valley and a piece of the barrier scraped my backside. No. Of course there isn't a god. If so, he would have healed me." There was an embarrassed silence for some time, And then Vera said, "Well, I don't know about it. I've prayed to, but I've never heard an answer to my prayers, and I've never seen any angel viruses floating about in the air. Have you?" The others sat in silence for a moment, and then a most dreadful catastrophe occurred. From out of space a great something swooped down and scraped all the great pillars on which they relied for shade. "Oh my goodness me, my goodness me," said Brynhilda as the great something swept by. "That was a close shave, wasn't it? We were nearly wiped out that time. But having escaped one danger from outer space, it must have been a UFO," they thought. Another matter happened. A sudden stinging flood fell upon them, and they had a shockingly antiseptic smell pour over them, and all of a sudden Vera, Brynhilda, Bunyanwara and Kataguama ceased to exist as the world called human dubbed astringent on his face. Miss Ant sat placidly on a great stone. Carefully she brushed her antennae and made sure that all her legs were clean and tidy. She had to be sure she was looking absolutely as perfect as she could be, because she was going out walking with a soldier ant who had been given unexpected leave. She turned to her friend, Bertha Black Beetle, who was snoozing in the heat of the noonday sun. "Bertha, you great oaf," she said, "give me a good examination, will you? Make sure everything is as it should be." Bertha roused up and opened one eye, and looked with care at Miss Ant. "My, oh my, you sure do look swell," she said. "Our soldier boy will be knocked straight off his legs when he sees you. But it's too early, you know. Sit down and enjoy the sunlight." Together they sat and looked out on the desolate world before them. There were great boulders, immense boulders which reared up 20 times the height of Miss Ant, and in between there was dry, dry earth. Not a blade of grass was to be seen, not a bit of weed, nothing but desolation and vast peculiar marks in the soil. Miss Ant looked up at the sky and said, "Bertha, all my life I have wanted a soldier boy of my own, and I prayed that I should have such a friend. Do you think my prayer has been answered?" Bertha wobbled one of her antennae, and then said slowly and carefully, "Gee, I don't know. I don't believe in a god myself. If there is one, he's never heard any of my prayers. When I was much younger, in fact when I was in the grub stage, I often used to pray to a god I had been told about, but the prayers were never answered, and I came to the conclusion that I was, well, you know, wasting my time. What's the good of believing in a god if he is not godlike enough to give us a bit of proof? That's what I say." Idly she turned a complete circle and sat down again. Miss Ant carefully knitted with her front legs, and then said, "It really is a problem, you know, Bertha, it really is a problem. I wonder if all those points of light we see at night are other worlds, and if they are other worlds, do you think anyone lives on them? Funny to think if this is the only world and we are the only people on it. What do you think, eh?" Bertha heaved a sigh of exasperation, and then said, "Well, I don't know that there are other worlds or not. I think it's something quite different. I met another insect some months ago, and he said, he was a winged insect, that he had flown a long, long way, and then he came to a tremendous pillar, oh such a vast pillar that I couldn't even believe what he was telling me. And he said that at a certain time every night the top of the pillar went bright. Now I can't believe that there would be a world which only came bright when our world was getting dark. What do you think?" Miss Ant was getting more and more confused. "Well, I always was taught that this world was made for us insects. I was always taught that there is no form of life greater than us insects. That's you and me, Bertha. So if that is true, if our priests are right, then surely there can't be anything more clever than us. And they'd have to be a lot more clever than us if they could turn their world to existence only when this world went dark. I don't know what to believe, but I think there is a big purpose behind it all, and, like you, I am getting a bit tired of praying to a god who never bothers to answer." Time went on and the shadows began to lengthen. From a short distance away an ant voice called out, "Hey, Miss Ant, Miss Ant, where are you? I've got a message for you." Miss Ant got to her legs and moved forward over to the edge of the big stone. "Yes, yes, what is it?" she called down, looking at another ant standing some distance away. The other ant looked up and wiggled with her to Anton Nay, and then she said, "Your soldier boy has gone and left you. He said that after all he thought you weren't the right ant girl for him, so he's gone off with that fast young hussy who lives way up there," and she turned pointing. Miss Ant sat down with a thud, her whole world collapsed about her. She had been praying for a soldier boy to come and make love to her, and then they would make a nest together. But now, what did life have for her now? Miss Ant and Bertha started suddenly as a tremendous thudding came along the ground, thudding like an approaching earthquake. They stood to the full extent of their legs trying to see what was happening, but before they could move dark shapes swooped out of the distance and Miss Ant and her friend and the messenger ant, too, were squashed into pulp as schoolboys just leaving afternoon classes swept across their playground on their way home. Away in the country the grass was standing tall. It was beautiful there, healthy grass as green could be, the suns had warmed it, the rains had nourished it, and now it was a field worthy of anyone's delight. Deep in the depths of a field which seemed to be a veritable forest to its inhabitants, two little field mice played about among the stalks of grass, played about on the earth, and then ran up the thicker stalks and jumped from one to the other. One jumped high and leapt right up above the top of the grass. As he came tumbling down with shrieks of merriment, he fell at the feet of an old mouse. "Be careful, youngster," the old mouse said, "you're being too gay, you know. There's no gaiety like that in this world. Soon a great mystery will occur. All our forest will tumble down before the onslaught of such a vast machine that none of us can even guess what it is. By the state of this grass I can see that we haven't much longer, so we'd better return to our burrows." The old mouse, a wise old she-mouse, turned and toddled off. The two young mice looked at each other and then looked at her retreating form. Then one said, "Oh, isn't she a miserable old spoil sport?" The other said, "Yes, I guess she doesn't like children, she wants to keep us as slaves bringing nuts and stuff like that, and getting nothing for it." For some time the young field mice played about together, and then a rustling chill in the air reminded them that evening was starting, so with one startled glance up at the darkened sky they hurried along together to their home. They sat in the dusk at the mouth of their burrow communing in spirit, nibbling a piece of grass, looking up occasionally to be very sure that night owls did not see them. After a time the round orb of a silvery moon started its glide across the dark sky. One little mouse said to the other, "Wonder what it's like up there? I wonder if there are any field mice on that big thing that we see so often?" "Oh, don't be stupid," said the other field mouse. "Of course there is nothing except this world." Then he added with a note of uncertainty in his voice, "Oh yes, I often think the same as you, I often think, well, there must be worlds with field mice on besides this world. I know our priests tell us that this world was made especially for field mice and there is no higher form of life than us field mice." "Ah yes," said the other field mouse, "but then the priests tell us we should pray." "Well, goodness me, I prayed hard enough, I prayed for fresh cheese and things like that, but never, never have I had a prayer answered. I think if there had been a God then it would be such a simple matter to put down a bit of fresh cheese for a young field mouse every so often. What do you think?" He turned to his companion expectantly, but the other said, "Well, I don't know, I'm sure. I prayed as well but I've never had any proof that there is a field mouse god nor have I ever seen any field mice angels flying about." "No," said the other, "only these night owls and people like that." On that solemn thought they turned on the instant and dived down into their burrow. The night wore on and various creatures of the darkness came out looking for food, but the little field mice were safely hidden in their burrow. In the morning the day dawned bright and there was warmth in the air. The little field mice set about their daily task. They left their burrow and off they went into the green forest of grass to see what food they could get for the day. All of a sudden they crouched against the earth, their blood feeling as if it had turned to ice within them. A most hellish, unearthly uproar was coming toward them, a noise such as they had never heard before. They were too frightened to move. One whispered hurriedly to the other, "Quick, quick, let us pray for protection, Let us pray for salvation. And those were the last words the little field mouse said, because the farmer with his reaping machine drove straight over them and their bodies were cut to shreds and flung among the cut grass. From the Great Pyramid with its flat top and turreted sides came the blare of trumpets, their brazen voices echoing and re-echoing through the valley at the foot of the pyramid, which was indeed a holy temple. People looked at each other in affright. Were they late? What was happening? Such a blaring occurred only in times of crisis or when the fat slovenly priests had something to say to the people. With one accord they dropped what they were doing and hastened along the well-trodden path leading to the plinth of the pyramid. Here there were broad, broad steps leading perhaps a third the way up the pyramid, and all the way around there were extrusions, extensions, almost like balconies, or perhaps a better term would be walled walks, and along these walled walks or balconies the priests were wont to take their leisure. Two by two they would go along, hands clasped behind their backs or held within their ample sleeves. Two by two they went along thinking of the words of God, pondering upon the mysteries of the universe. Here in the clear atmosphere so high up in the Andes it was so easy to see the stars at night, so easy to believe in other worlds. But the population of the valley was now coming in force up the great steps and surging into the main body of the temple. Within the dim interior so highly charged with incense smoke people coughed a little, and here and there a countryman used only to the freshest of fresh air rubbed his eyes as they started to water and smart as the acrid smoke of the incense attacked them. The lights were dim, but at one end of the temple stood a vast idol of polished bronze, a sitting human figure. And yet no, it was not quite a human, it was different in subtle ways. It was superhuman, but it towered many stories high, and the people at its base walking about could only reach up to half knee height. The congregation entered, and then when the priest in charge saw that the great hall was almost full there came the deep booming of a gong. Sharp eyes, unaffected by the incense smoke, could see the great gong quivering. Quivering at the right hand of the godlike figure. The booming continued, but no one was hitting the gong, no one was doing anything within yards of it, but the booming continued. And then, without human hands, the great doors of the temple closed. For a moment there was silence, and then upon the knee of the god there appeared the high priest. Clad in flowing robes. His hands and arms were raised above his head, he looked down at the people and said, God hath spoken to us, God is dissatisfied with the help you give your temple. So many of you withhold your tithe, God will speak to you. With that he turned and went on his knees facing the torso of the great figure. Then the mouth of the figure opened and from it came a booming. People dropped to their knees, people closed their eyes and clasped their hands together, and then the booming gave way to a strong, strong voice. I'm your God, said the figure. I am disappointed at the increasing lack of respect shown to my servants, your priests. Unless you are more obedient and more generous in your offerings you will be afflicted with plagues, with migraines, and with many sores and boils, and your crops shall wither before your eyes. Obey your priests. They are my servants, they are my children. Obey, obey, obey. The voice faded out and the mouth closed. The high priest got to his feet again and turned to face his congregation. Then he presented a fresh set of demands, more food, more money, more services, more young women for the temple virgins. Then he disappeared. He did not turn and walk away, he disappeared, and the great temple doors opened again. Outside there were lines of priests on each side, and each had a collecting bowl in his hands. The temple was empty. The idol lay silent. But no, no, not so silent, because a visiting priest in the temple was being shown around by a very, very close friend. From the idol came whisperings and rustlings, and the visiting priest commented upon it. His friend replied, "Oh yes, they are just giving a check of the acoustics. You haven't seen inside our idol, have you? Come along and I'll show you." Together the two priests moved to the back of the idol and the resident priest pressed his hands in a certain pattern on an ornamentation. A hidden door opened and the two priests entered. The idol was not solid, it was a series of chambers. They went in and climbed series of stairways until they got up to chest level. Here was a very strange room indeed. There was a bench and a seat before it, and in front of the seat there was a mouthpiece which led to a series of tubbings intricately convoluted which led upwards to the throat. At one side there were two seats and a series of levers. The resident priest said, "Those two levers are operated by two priests. They activate the jaws and we have had so much practice that we can move the jaws exactly in time with the speech." He moved over and said, "Look out here. The speaker can see the congregation at all times without being seen himself." The visitor moved over and looked out through narrow eye slits. He could see the great temple. He could see cleans busy sweeping the floors. Then he turned to see what his friend was doing. His friend was sitting in front of the mouthpiece. He said, "We have a special priest who has a very authoritative voice. He is never allowed out to mix with other people because he is the voice of our God. When required he sits here and he says his message through this mouthpiece. First of all he removes the slide here and then his voice goes out through the mouth, and so long as this slide is in place nothing one says here can be heard outside." Together they moved down into the main body of the temple again, talking all the time. The resident said, "We have to do this, you know. I don't know if there is a God or not, I often wonder, but I am very sure that God does not answer our prayers. I have been here now for 40 years and I have never yet known a prayer answered, but we have to keep our authority." The visitor replied and said, "Yes, I stand upon our high peak at night and I look up at the sky, and I see all the little pinpoints of light, and I wonder if they are holes in the floor of heaven or if it's all imagination. Is there heaven? Or are those pinpoints of light other worlds? And if there are other worlds then how do they go on there?" The resident replied, "Yes, I have many doubts myself. There must be some controlling entity, but it does seem to me from my own experience that he never answers prayers. That is why 1,000 years or more ago this metal figure was built, so that we priests could maintain our power, our hold, over people, and possibly help them where God ignored them. I believe that all life is made up of vibrations, and a vibration is just a cycle. We say a thing shakes. Well, we mean it goes up and it goes down, and it goes up and it goes down. If you draw a line on a piece of paper then you can draw another line curving up from your first line, curving over, and coming down again and going the same distance down before turning to go up. Here we have a cycle, a vibration, a pictorial diagram of a vibration similar to that used in biorhythm or in symbols for electric current of the alternating variety. But all life is like that. It is like the swinging of a pendulum. It goes from one side of a neutral point, through the neutral point, and up an equal distance to the other side. And then the pendulum swings again and goes through the procedure time after time after time. I believe that all nature goes through cycles. I believe that everything that exists is a vibration, alternating from up to down, from positive to negative, from good to bad, and, if you come to think about it, without having bad there would be no good because good is the opposite of bad as bad is the opposite of good. I believe in a God. I believe very firmly in a God. But I also believe that the God may be too busy to deal with us on an individual basis. I believe that if we pray to our over-self, to our superior soul, if you like, but that is not God. I believe that there are two gods, the God of good, positive, and the God of bad, negative. The latter we call Satan. Very definite intervals, at opposite swings of the pendulum. The good God rules the earth and all things living and then we have a golden age. But the pendulum swings, the cycle moves on and then the power of the good God, the positive side, wanes and after it passes a neutral point where the powers of good and bad are equal then it goes up to favor the other side of the swing, the bad, Satan. And then we have what is so often called the age of Kali. The age of disruption, the age when everything goes wrong, and looking about the earth today at vandals, wars, politicians, can you deny that we are now in the age of Kali? We are coming up to the peak of the swing. And conditions will get worse and worse until at last the swing will be at its topmost point for bad and conditions will be very bad indeed. Strikes, earthquakes, the powers of evil let loose unchecked. And then, as always, the pendulum will change direction, will fall, and the powers of evil will wane and there will be a resurgence of better feeling upon the earth. Once again the neutral point when good and bad are equal will be reached and passed, and the pendulum will climb up to good, and as it climbs up things will be better and better. Perhaps then when we have a golden age the God of this universe will be able to listen to our prayers and will, maybe, afford us some proof that he does care about those lodged down here on this world. I believe that at the present time the press, the media, television and all the rest of it contribute very largely to the increase of evil because we read even in the press itself how children of 7 years of age are taught to commit murder, children of 10 years of age set up murder gangs in Vancouver. I believe that the press should be suppressed, and television, radio, and film should be censored. But about gods? Yes, I believe there is a God. In fact, I believe there are different grades of gods. We call them manas, and people who cannot understand the concept of gods should look at conditions in a big departmental store. It doesn't matter what name you choose for the store, let us say a big chain of supermarket stores. At the very top you have God, the president or general manager, depending on which country you live in and the terminology employed. But the man at the top is the all-powerful one who dictates what shall be done. Yet this man, this chairman of the board of directors or president or general manager, is so busy with his immense power that he does not have time to deal with the smallest office boy or the smallest minor clerk who hands out food and puts it in bags. This particular man, the god of the supermarket, represents God himself, the head manu of our universe, the one who has control of many different worlds. He is so important, so powerful, so busy that he is not able to deal with individual worlds, not able to deal with individual countries, and definitely not able to deal with individuals, individual humans, individual animals, for animals have as many rights as humans in the celestial scheme of things. The supermarket president or manager cannot see to everything himself, so he appoints under managers and supervisors and overseers, and that corresponds in the spatial system to manas. There is God the Almighty, and in our own scheme there is the Manu of Earth, the manager who is responsible for the overall management of this Earth. Under him there are subordinate manas, supervisors if you like, of each continent of the Earth. Supervisors or manas of each country of the Earth. They guide the destiny of the countries, they influence what the politicos are doing although the politicos can make enough mess without any manas to help them. There is one creature who is known as the Eye of God. The cat. The cat can go anywhere, do anything, see anything, for who takes much notice of a cat strolling around? People say, oh it's only the cat, it's nothing. And the cat goes on watching and reporting good and bad. Evil forces cannot control cats. Cats have a divine barrier which prevents evil thoughts, that is why in one century cats are venerated as divinities. And in another century they are execrated as disciples of the devil because the devil people want to get rid of cats who report on evil deeds, and there is nothing the devils can do about it. At the present time the man who controlling the earth is Satan. At the present time Satan is very well in control of the earth, not much good can happen at the present time. Look for yourself at that evil Satan-like group, the communists. Look at all the cults with their misleading religion and how they try to gain dominance over those who are foolish enough to join their evil cults, but eventually Satan will be forced to abandon the earth, forced to withdraw his minions just as a business which fails has to close down. Soon there will become a time when the pendulum will reverse its direction and with its reverse of direction evil will weaken, good will strengthen, but that time is not yet. Face increasingly bad times until the pendulum really swings. Think of this, you look at the pendulum, you think it is always moving but it is not, you know, it is not even moving at the same speed because the pendulum is at its height on, let us say, the right side, and then it falls down with increasing speed until it is at its bottommost point. There it is, its maximum speed of the pendulum climbing up to the other side slows the arm of the pendulum and at the end of the stroke the pendulum stops, quite definitely the pendulum stops for an appreciable time before falling again to climb up the other side. Depending upon our time reference we are able to say that with the average clock the stoppage is for a fraction of a second only.